I'm not sure who it was who said, if you're going to fail, fail spectacularly. Cutthroat Island, The Alamo, The Adventures of Pluto Nash, those are movies that failed spectacularly. Huge box office disasters that lost their movie studios well over $100 million each, but they have nothing on John Carter. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, the new Disney adventure film is poised to go down as one of the biggest Hollywood flops ever.
A Civil War vet is transplanted to Mars, where he meets aliens. I believe they're speaking Barsoomian, but that's the least of John Carter's problems. Its opening weekend only made about $30 million at the box office, and Disney released a statement saying they're expecting to lose about $200 million on the movie, which cost over $350 million to make and market.
Well, you know, investors are going to be perturbed. You know, how could you put this much money into a movie that, you know, your grandmother could have told you was probably not worth it?
Barton Crockett is an entertainment analyst at Lazard Capital Markets. He says the loss for Disney Studios is huge, but he says the multi-billion dollar Disney empire will survive.
Even losing $200 million on a movie is, you know, just a drop in the bucket at Disney.
Disney is a lot more than just its movies. It has theme parks, merchandise, and most lucrative of all, its cable channels, driven in profits by ESPN. Disney acknowledged John Carter's dismal results, but in a statement said it was excited about upcoming releases, The Avengers and Brave.
Oh, come on! Shit, boy!
Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
And that brings us to our last word in business this morning, an infamous retirement. 23 years ago this week, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker spilled millions of gallons of oil into waters off the coast of Alaska. It was the worst tanker spill in U.S. history. Now, after the spill, the ship was renamed the Oriental Nicety. Call it what you will, that ship is now headed for the scrap heap. The more than 200,000-ton vessel will fetch $16 million for its scrap parts. And that is the business news on Morning Edition. From NPR News, I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. For the past year, a small spacecraft called MESSENGER has been orbiting the planet Mercury. Meantime, back on Earth, astronomers are meeting in Texas to talk about MESSENGER. And today, as NPR's Joe Palca reports, they revealed what they've learned so far about our solar system's innermost planet, including some surprises.
MESSENGER's orbit takes it to within 125 miles of the planet, and from there you can get a pretty good view. But don't expect any dazzling color pictures.
Mercury is very gray, and it's pretty dark gray, even less color variations on Mercury than we see on the Moon.
Maria Zuber is an astronomer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and one of the lead scientists on the MESSENGER mission.
So Mercury is not a very colorful planet.
But interesting.
But fascinating.
That's why Zuber has been willing to hang around for the data she knew MESSENGER would be providing. And she's been waiting for that data for quite a while.
The launch date was August 3rd, 2004.
Now, you may be thinking, wait a minute, Mercury isn't all that far from the Earth. Spitting distance in astronomical terms, why does it take nearly 8 years to get there? Zuber says the answer is gravity. Mercury's orbit is close to the Sun, and if you launch a rocket towards the Sun, which is massive and has a much stronger gravity field than tiny Mercury, it's going to make the spacecraft speed up and head directly for the Sun.
And in order to get into orbit around the planet, the spacecraft has to slow down enough for the planet's gravity field to capture it.
If you have a giant rocket engine, you can use that to slow you down, but MESSENGER didn't have one. So instead, mission managers chose a route worthy of Rube Goldberg. MESSENGER did a loop around Earth and two close encounters with Venus, using those gravity fields as a kind of brake, counteracting the Sun's pull. When it arrived at Mercury in 2008, it was still going too fast to go into orbit, so it flew by Mercury three times, slowing down a little more each time.
And the fourth time it came by Mercury, it was slowed down enough that when we fired the spacecraft's main engine, Mercury's gravity field was able to capture it.
MESSENGER has been orbiting Mercury since March 2011. As Zuber and her colleagues reported today at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Houston, and are publishing this week in the journal Science, Mercury has some puzzling features. For example, Zuber used MESSENGER's instruments to study a large crater 900 miles across called Caloris.
The northern half of Caloris's floor has actually been uplifted so that it's actually higher than its rim. And of course, craters are holes in the ground, but this hole in the ground was uplifted so high that the base of the crater is above its rim.
Another surprise is how big Mercury's core is. It's big. Zuber says to get an idea, if Mercury were an orange, the core would be the size of the fruit, while the outer crust and mantle would only be as thick as the orange peel. That's a much bigger core proportionally than the Earth has. Sean Solomon of the Carnegie Institution for Science is another one of MESSENGER's principal scientists. He says the spacecraft's original mission was supposed to end after 1 year, but it was working so well they convinced NASA to keep it going.
Just on Sunday, we began the MESSENGER extended mission,
which will last another year, so astronomers expect they'll have more to say at next year's meeting. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Finally today, do you mind if I take a few minutes to tell you about my son? He has three beautiful sisters, but right now I just want to tell you about him. He's 8 now, and he loves anything that involves dirt, a ball, and running around. He still has deliciously long eyelashes and long musician's fingers. He's learning to play the guitar. He likes to act as if he's older than he is. A couple of days ago, he asked me if I thought his Nerf basketball set was old school and if his next babysitter could be hot, whatever that means. The answer to both is no, by the way. But every so often, thankfully, my husband and I are reminded that he is still a little boy. Like the time a few weeks ago when he was not feeling well and he came into our room at 2 a.m. clutching his green stuffed bunny. He came in because he was afraid, and I was reminded that even at 2 a.m., one of the pleasures of being a parent is to be able to comfort your child when he is afraid. Can I just tell you, that is why, if you are a parent, and frankly, even if you aren't, you should be able to understand why so many people are so shaken and so hurt about the death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in Florida. Shot to death, as we talked about previously on the program, while he was walking home from the store in a neighborhood outside Orlando that he was visiting. Shot to death because a neighbor, a self-appointed neighborhood watch guy named George Zimmerman, decided the teenager looked suspicious and took it upon himself to follow him. Now, I wasn't there, but one thing I do know is that there is already a lot to digest in what we all know, like the fact that there had been a series of break-ins in the area, which tends to make people on edge, the fact that the police dispatcher told George Zimmerman to back off, and he didn't, and the fact that witnesses have accused the local police of shaping their statements to fit the shooter's defense rather than objectively pursuing the facts. But what I want to focus on today is something we don't ever seem to talk about, the fact that Trayvon Martin was afraid. That's something we know because, according to his family's lawyer, he was on the phone with a friend and told the friend he was being followed by a strange man. That friend told him to run, and he did, toward the house where he was staying, but he never made it. Why does it never seem to occur to anybody that young black men can be afraid? Let's face it, when we think about why crime frightens us, doesn't the person who comes to mind, the person whose victimization we most fear, is probably somebody who looks like our mother, our sister, a wife or girlfriend? But if you think about who is actually most likely to be killed, that victim is far more likely to be a man and far more likely to be a black or brown man. In 2010, according to the FBI, some 1,800 black people under the age of 22 were murdered. That's 50% more than the total number of whites that age who were killed. But it's even more depressing when you consider that blacks are just 13% of the population. And yes, it's true that the people bringing the pain are most likely to look exactly like the people they're hurting. Case in point, over the weekend in Chicago, at least 10 people were killed. At least half appeared to have been victims of a rivalry among Latino gangs. A 6-year-old girl was among the victims. But that is all the more reason why, when the innocent suffer, attention must be paid. And also why attention must be paid when the many are forced to wear the cloak of suspicion caused by the acts of a few. My son is so young now and so innocent, so happy that he can ride his scooter to the new playground down the street. His biggest worry right now is getting tally marks for forgetting to raise his hand in class and losing precious minutes of recess as punishment. How long will it be before my biggest fear will be having to wait with my heart in my chest every time he walks out the door alone? And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Big news from the National Football League today. The league slammed the New Orleans Saints with severe sanctions over the team's bounty program. Players got big bonuses for hits that knocked opponents out of games. Saints head coach Sean Payton has been suspended without pay for the entire 2012 season. Former defensive coordinator Greg Williams is out indefinitely. The Saints' general manager is suspended for a half year. The team will have to pay $500,000 in fines, and it will lose two draft picks. NPR sports correspondent Mike Pesca joins us now. And Mike, those are pretty harsh punishments. Are they surprising to you?
They are harsh, and I think people thought that the hammer would come down on Greg Williams because he was at the center of this bounty program. He either oversaw or at very least countenanced it, and that was what was somewhat surprising. Bounty programs on a smaller scale have existed throughout the NFL for years, but to have a coach be in the middle of it was weird and troubling to the league. But I think the most surprising thing is the sanction against Sean Payton and the sanction for a full year. One of the reasons that the NFL was so upset with this program, apart from the sportsmanship, apart from legal liability, is that the Saints lied to them. They looked into it in 2010. The Saints said it had stopped. It had not stopped. Commissioner Roger Goodell says, well, now, by God, we're going to stop you.
So will the Saints handle this? Do you think it'll actually cost them some wins next year after all?
You know, it's easy to say. If you're a Saints fan now, you think it's terrible. And Drew Brees tweeted, I need to understand this. Well, there is a large document online available to everyone that details the Saints program. I think that though Sean Payton is a mastermind of a coach, his system is already in place. They missed a couple games with Payton. He was out with a broken leg this year. They did fine under their offensive coordinator, Pete Carmichael. So I think they should be okay. And I think the league didn't want to hurt the Saints from a competition standpoint. That wasn't what the league wanted to do. They tried to balance giving a harsh penalty, but still letting the Saints be really one of the best teams in the NFC.
And so the message is?
The message is to other teams, first of all, it's not just a message, but literally all teams have to now positively affirm that no bounty program is going on, which is a mind-boggling step when you think about it, that they have to go to the point where they have to affirm that one is not taking place. But also, they're sending a message to teams and also to the public and potential jurors, because there are many lawsuits now against the NFL for head injuries. And the NFL did not want a situation where there was willful injuring of players and they didn't do enough about it. The NFL very much wants to say, as soon as this came to our attention, we acted swiftly and severely, and that's the message that they want to give.
Now, Mike, there's actually some non-litigious NFL news today as well. Let's go on to that. The other big story involves quarterback Tim Tebow, who was replaced yesterday in Denver by Peyton Manning. Today, it appears he's headed to New York to become a Jet.
Yes. Well, it's not litigious, but it might involve, I don't know, torts or contracts, actually, contracts, because this trade might get held up. He is owed a lot of money. And the report is the Jets were so eager to sign the very high profile Tebow that they didn't scrutinize his contract. So if the trade does happen, the situation is the Jets now have a very high profile backup quarterback, a quarterback who could play a few downs on offense, and perhaps a quarterback who will make their incumbent QB, Mark Sanchez, very nervous and insecure, but perhaps making Mark Sanchez somewhat secure is the fact that he did sign a $40 million extension. So here in New York, everyone is worrying about Mark Sanchez's psyche. You know, I would like to be in a position where perhaps my bosses didn't give me a vote of confidence, but on the other hand, they gave me $40 million. $1,000.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Mike Pesca in New York.